From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and this week, we're celebrating Christmas the way real people do, with music.
Can I find an hour's worth of soulful Christmas music in a whole variety of moods? But let it be wonderful. Let it be something that bears repeated listening.
With family.
Every time I have tried to watch any kind of TV or movie with any member of my family, it's like an episode of Mystery Science Theater 3000, only Latino style.
And sometimes with a little sadness.
When I crossed the border into El Salvador, you could just feel immediately the sense of oppression in the country.
All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. No se vayan. It's Latino USA, people, and it's the holiday edition. I'm Maria Hinojosa. So, Christmas is just around the corner, and with it comes all kinds of feelings. Depending on your situation, it can be funny, sad, full of memories, or full of melancholy. It's also a time to remember and think about the true message of Christmas, giving to the less fortunate. This week, we'll cover all of that range of emotions, but we start our coverage with a discussion about those less fortunate ones, victims of war and urban violence. The Central American wars that forced many people north to the United States in the 80s and 90s are, perhaps, the least remembered of American military ventures. Our country participated by training military officers from El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and Nicaragua, investing cash by the millions and weapons in the name of fighting communism. And the effects have lasted. Donna DeCesare, a photojournalist and writer, has documented those effects for decades. Her bilingual book, Unsettled, Desasosiego, chronicles her journeys from 1987 to 2003. Donna DeCesare joins me in the studio now. It's great to have you back on Latino USA.
Thank you, Maria. It's great to be here.
You and I met sometime in the late 1980s. We were both budding journalists. In the end, Central America became the defining work in your life. What made it become that?
There was just something about Central America when I went there. I went to Costa Rica, actually, first. But Nicaragua is the place where I really started photographing a lot. And I remember being in this village, and I was documenting peasant life, and it just reminded me of my Italian grandmother's stories about growing up in southern Italy. Of course, it's a completely different culture, an indigenous culture, not the same as, but so many aspects of life were just like my grandmother had talked about, cooking on a wood fire, carrying water on your head. These were things, slaughtering a pig. These were things my grandmother did in her childhood and that I grew up on those stories. So there was just something that was both different enough to intrigue me with the difference, but familiar enough for me to really feel a sense of connection, almost like a family connection to the people. And I really just fell in love with the place.
So what happened in that process? You are photographing this place that you thought was beautiful and idyllic, somewhat, memories of, you know, your grandmother in Italy. But then what did you begin to witness and capture with your camera?
Well, I moved at the end of 87 to live in El Salvador, and it was a completely different experience from Nicaragua. Nicaragua was at war, the Contra war was on, but the atmosphere in the country was much more hopeful and idealistic. People loved the camera and they would come to you. I would say they would kiss the camera. They were so excited about meeting someone. When I crossed the border into El Salvador, it sort of everyone had, you know, their eyes averted, their head down. You could just feel immediately the sense of oppression in the country. And, you know, I wanted to understand this. Why is it like this? And I remembered there was a nun that I had met in Nicaragua, Sister Fabiola. The order of nuns that she worked with were also working in the conflict zones. And so I wanted to learn about what was happening there. The FMLN, the Farabundo Martí National Liberation Front, was five different guerrilla organizations that came together basically to fight once the Salvadoran army and the death squad started killing priests and labor activists and teachers all over the country. They knew that they couldn't any longer try to win a political voice through the legitimate political means because there were none, and had to get a housekeeper. And I didn't really want to have a housekeeper. I'd never had a housekeeper before in my life. And yet I had to hire somebody because you couldn't rent a house without a housekeeper. So that's why I went to the nuns. And they introduced me to a young woman who had been with the FMLN. But Adela came from this region, Chalatenango, that I wanted to go to. When I met her, you know, I was sort of torn because, you know, okay, so I'm going to have someone who's actually on one of the sides in this conflict in my house. Is that a wise thing to do? But when I met her, I just couldn't say no. She was a young mother. She really needed the job. And as we grew to trust one another, I got this incredible access because of her family who still lived in the zone and were civilians, obviously with some role because they decided to stay. They supported the FMLN, but they were not combatants themselves.
A lot of the images in your book are clearly stunning. They're gripping. They, you know, you just have to stop and come back to it, and because many of them are so powerful, and many of them feature children. There are several of them with kids that can't be more than 12 holding automatic rifles or tattooed. I want to know if you would read this passage from your book describing one of your experiences in El Salvador.
In the alley outside one of the classrooms at the Salvadoran Army's principal training base, Military Training Center of the Armed Forces, where I'd been photographing, a boy approached furtively. He asked me to call him Jose and confided tearfully that he'd been taken off the bus the week before as he was returning from his grandmother's home. "My mom doesn't know where I am," he sobbed. "She must be worried," I said gently. He nodded nervously and whispered, "Don't tell them what I told you."
What you were capturing there was the fact that the Salvadoran military at the time, though they denied it, they were forcibly recruiting child soldiers. This notion of children as actors in the theater of war was something that I suppose we become a little bit more informed about now. But what was that like for you to uncover that and to be photographing it?
I was shocked, frankly, Maria, because I understood why children who were orphaned or who had lost family members might be motivated to take up arms with the insurgency. But I didn't understand how the Salvadoran government could justify recruiting kids as young as 13. We kept being told they were changing, it was getting better. And this was in 1989. This was near the end of the war. This wasn't at the beginning, in the early stages. And constitutionally, they had the right, they had a draft. They recruited everybody over 18. Why did they need kids? And why did they, you know, why did they do this? I mean, it just didn't make any sense to me.
The cover photograph of your book, it is a little girl. She's sitting on a bed. It looks like she could be in Central America. In fact, she's in Los Angeles. And on the bed right next to her, she's holding a dove. And right next to her on the bed is...
It was a pellet gun, a loaded pellet gun. And after I took the picture, she asked me if I wanted to see the other guns. There was lots of other guns in the house that she could have pulled out. And I said to her, "Grandmother, please put it away." That picture was made on a day when I went to visit actually her uncle, who was 16 years old that day. It was his 16th birthday. He'd never had a birthday cake. And I'd seen him earlier that morning. And when we were talking, he revealed it was his birthday. So I asked him if he'd be home later. Could I come over? And he said, yeah, he'd be home all day. He wasn't doing anything. When I got there, he wasn't there. But so I started to talk to his mother. And it was sort of as we were talking during the hours that I was waiting for Giovanni to come home, that picture happened. That image contains in it just everything about this issue, You know, it's like the innocence of childhood, the desperate longing for peace and for hope, this symbol of the bird, the gun, which is the, you know, the other, that sort of duality of life and death, and sort of this child, the child's innocence, and which way is she going to go? And we don't know.
Once you've been to El Salvador, then you get back to Los Angeles, you spend a lot of time doing photographs with gang members. And a lot of times people in this country just see Central American gangs. And they just think that these gangs from Central America were born in Central America and have always been around, and Central Americans have always been part of gangs. And it's like, actually, no. The United States played a major role in the creation of Central American gangs. Tell a little bit, so people might make that connection, of what it is that the United States did that helped to create the situation where the gangs are not the problem in and of themselves. There's a symptom, and they were created, in fact, by El Norte.
Yes. And that's one of the tragic ironies of the war. We supported a military regime that was repressing people, and we sent a lot of weapons to Central America. And there was extreme cruelty in the violence of the death squads that operated there. And we did nothing really much to stop that. In fact, there were even training manuals that were used, that were written by the CIA on interrogation techniques that now we ourselves are using more openly. But we were part of the training regime. And so we have that history. And on top of that history, we have the history of the people who fled that terrible violence and came seeking safety in our country. And because of the neighborhoods that they ended up moving to, their kids grew up in a world of gangs that was an American world of gangs. And yet, when the Central American kids got involved in gangs or formed their own as a response to being persecuted or picked on by other gangs, what happened next was that the U.S. started deporting young people back to Central America. And they're getting sent back to a very volatile post-war situation with a lot of weaponry around. They start to basically form little groups so that they can feel protected and figure out how they're going to survive in this new environment.
There's a photograph that you think kind of captures the desperation of what's happening with the gangs and the violence now. It's well, I'm going to let you describe what we see in that photograph.
It's a photograph that I made at the funeral for a gang leader who was murdered in prison. And it's a group of his homeboys at the funeral, clasping hands across the grave where the body has just been lowered. And they're making a revenge pact to kill the person who killed their homeboy. And this is, to me, one of the most chilling moments that I witnessed, because I could see then this becomes a cycle without end. And the more that you try to repress it and treat it violently, the more virulently violent it will become.
Thank you so much, Donna, for joining us on Latino USA. You have certainly made photography mean something in our lives.
Thank you, Maria.
Donna DeTesare is an award-winning photographer and professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin. Check out our website, latinousa.org, to hear an extended version of our interview. Coming up on Latino USA, what it's like growing up with the most famous name of all.
They do see the name Jesus, the American name, as the actual person, Jesus Christ.
Stories of being Jesus. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Puedo imaginar.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. For Christians, Christmas is all about Jesus. But what about all the other people named Jesus? In Latin America, it's a name that's pretty much like any other. But here in the U.S., it's a name that might make some non-Latinos take pause. Latino USA producer Michael Simon Johnson spoke with a handful of Jesuses to find out what it's like to grow up with the holiest name in the book.
My name is Jesus Perez.
My name is Jesus Soto.
My name is Jesus Daniel Tapia León.
My name is Jesus Lugo. I'm 19 years old. I was born in the Bronx, born and raised there.
2,000 years ago, in the land of Galilee, Jesus was actually a fairly common name. Back then, Jesus was sort of like Josh.
Growing up in New York with the name Jesus has been, for the most part, I'm not going to say a little annoying, it's annoying.
2,000 years later, in Latin American and Latino communities, Jesus is still widely used. In Mexico, for instance, Jesus is the sixth most common name for boys. In the U.S., it's William, and think about how many bills you know. So for the American Jesus, this can create problems of biblical proportions.
Because there's the American Jesus, and then there's the Spanish Latin Jesus. So I've come across a lot of people who, for some reason, they feel, I guess you could say, offended.
Offended.
If they call me that, because I don't know what's the reason why.
Most of the Jesuses I talk to acknowledge that sometimes, though rarely, people have a kind of aversion to saying their name.
Like, if I was to tell someone, you can call me Jesus or Jesus, they right away say, I'd rather call you Jesus. I'm not going to call you Jesus. They do see the name Jesus, the American name, as the actual person, Jesus Christ.
So you don't mind being called Jesus?
I'm cool with that. That is my name.
Where were you born?
Here in San Antonio.
Jesus Perez says that people refer to him differently depending on the situation.
More so like in, I guess I call it my more fun job at SeaWorld. People call me Jesus, but people at my internship, they tend to call me Jesus. I guess it's more professional setting.
You know, I guess they feel like saying Jesus is like a lower version and it's not as important, which it is. It's equally important, to me at least.
Jesus Soto from Los Angeles.
San Fernando Valley, to be more precise.
He was working at a bank when
an older white gentleman, I would say in his late 50s, early 60s, you know, he saw my nameplate and he's like, your name is Jesus? I went ahead and corrected him. I'm like, no, my name is Jesus. But if you can't say it and pronounce it correctly, I'm like, you're more than welcome to call me Jesus. And at that point, he, like, his facial expression just changed. He just got angry. He's like, you know what? That's blasphemous. I can't believe you even have that name. Your mother should have had more sense in naming you.
But then there are the other times when the name can be, shall we say, a blessing.
I don't promote myself to people as though, yes, you know, you hire me, you have Jesus on your side.
That's Jesus Avia.
I go by Jess typically now. I'm 57 years old and I'm a family law and criminal defense attorney in Punta Gorda, Florida.
He's also, full disclosure, my dad's old friend from college.
We had some funny times.
Anyway.
Because I'm an attorney here in Southwest Florida, there are times when people don't know who they're going to hire and they'll call our office and talk to my secretary and they'll say, is his name really Jesus? And she'll tell them it's Jesus, but yes, it's Jesus. And they'll say, well, then he's definitely the one for us.
I feel like my impulse would be to say, I love that you think that, but I want you to know I'm also a very good lawyer.
I certainly, once they actually meet with me and I let them know that, you know, you need to be hiring me on my merits, not on my name. And I'll tell you, there's some people who don't listen very carefully to that.
And this brings up one of the challenges of being Jesus. It's heavy.
In a way, and also the name just carries that pressure. I mean, I can't be a mean person ever, I think, and, you know, say my name is Jesus because that wouldn't fit.
At times, I did feel like I had to live up to expectations because of my name. And I think that's one of the reasons I really dislike my name, because of the weight behind the name. You know, once you start getting like into your teens, you start realizing, you know, that it's not like that.
Having a name, any name, means figuring out what that name means to you.
After high school, I started applying at places and I had to write my name. And I just, when I started hearing the name and, you know, hearing people calling me that name, it made me feel more mature, more grown up. Not necessarily for what it stood for, not the religious part or anything. I grew to like my name, to love it, actually.
For Latino USA?
You know what's another thing that I just thought about right now?
Go ahead.
You know, in the Spanish vocabulary, there's a word for when you meet somebody with the same name as you. It's called tocayo.
Oh, does it mean kind of like your brother?
Yeah.
You're connected somehow because of that?
Because of your name.
Huh. I don't have too many tocayos.
Well, I know a bunch of people now I can put you in touch with if you want to.
We could just like a Jesus fan club. Like us on Facebook.
For Latino USA, I'm Michael Simon Johnson.
So for all you Chewies out there, if you grew up with the name Jesus, tell us your story. Send us a tweet at LatinoUSA. So even though it's Christmas, we know you're thinking about the three kings, but it wouldn't be Christmas without the king, baby. Of course, I'm talking about Elvis, El Rey. And to celebrate this Christmas season, we bring you this story about Elvis from our archives. Latino USA's Nadia Raymond has our story.
Buenos noches, Brooklyn!
Cue in a small, dark-haired, pompadoured man wearing a Santa suit. Beneath all that red is Robert Lopez, a.k.a. Elvis, the 52-year-old Mexican Elvis.
I'm an Elvis interpreter, as opposed to translator. I'm translating it through Latino eyes, through Chicano eyes, and saying, you know, well, this is our version. It's like if Liberace taught Chicano studies, that would be Elvis. Viva Las Vegas turns into Viva La Raza.
In Elvis's hands, classic Elvis lyrics like "You ain't nothing but a hound dog" become "You ain't nothing but a chihuahua." And the line, "Don't you step on my blue suede shoes," goes like this.
No, peace of peace without you is too late. No. Where's us looking kid in a piece of space without just a suit?
If you're an LA rockabilly kid, this concert is your church, and Elvis is your patron saint. The show is filled with Spanglish-spitting, tattooed West Coast rock and rollers. But in between, you can also see well-dressed middle-aged Manhattanites and young punk rockers. Nanette Simmons is an Elvis convert, and she loves spreading the gospel.
I brought 10 of my friends here tonight to see him. And two of them were virgin Elvis. And now they fell in love, and now they're hooked. I love Elvis. I love him.
It's hard not to love Elvis. On stage, he's larger than life. He does splits in sparkly jumpsuits. He gets a little too up close and personal with the bassist. He even pretends to snort cocaine. But the man behind the mustache is surprisingly soft-spoken and even a little shy. Think Clark Kent. 25 years ago, Lopez was a curator at a small art gallery in Los Angeles. He put on a show about Elvis, and afterwards, a fan of the king told him about an Elvis tribute show in Memphis. Lopez dared himself to try and impersonate the king. He says he believes in making a fool of oneself in public, so he picked up the phone and used his knowledge of an old Elvis film to get the gig.
I actually lied when I was doing it and said, oh, there's a kid, a shoeshine boy in the film Fun in Acapulco, and I said, I am that boy grown up.
Mexico, Mexico, they've got muchas, muchachas, amigo.
Put a mustache with a Sharpie and faked it until I made it.
Never saw such adorable creature.
The Memphis show hired him, and Elvis never looked back. He's put on many shows and themed tours, even pretending to run for president under the slogan Elvis for Press. But his favorites are the Merry Mexmas Christmas shows.
Christmas was Elvis's favorite time of the year, and so it's kind of mixed with the Elvis mythology, and so I used things that were important to him, and I put a mustache on him. White Christmas, snow, or nothing that we had in San Diego and Chula Vista. And so the idea of saying, I'm dreaming of a brown Christmas took on a whole new idea.
Just like my ones in Mexico.
Elvis also sprinkles politics like fake snow throughout his entire act. The hit Suspicious Minds becomes Immigration Time. I can't walk out because my foot's caught in this border fence. And he writes new lyrics riffing on classic Christmas carols.
And this was to hark the herald to sing that a new king had been born, a Mexican king who would, who would spread the culture of Elvis and the culture of Latino. Viva la raza!
Concertgoer Carlos Fung was raised in Mexico, and he gets the many layers of Elvis.
What he has to say is very poignant. I mean, I know it's kind of tongue-in-cheek, the show, but there's a certain relevance about the whole political aspect.
Like many fans, Carlos sticks around after the show to get his picture taken with El Rey, the king, or to buy a Snow Way Jose Elvis record, or to get his very own Elvis Reprez M&Ms. But props aside, Elvis sees his interpreter role as something deeper.
What I am is satiring, paying homage on the Elvis culture, but also saying Elvis is an American icon. Being Mexican is part of the American culture. So you too can wear the crown.
And this is a little song to express the way I feel. Have yourself a very merry Xmas.
After the show ends, Elvis wipes away the mustache. He's calm and soft-spoken once more. In other words, Robert Lopez is back. At least until the next Merry Xmas show.
Ladies and gentlemen, Elvis has left the chimney. Thank you and good night.
For Latino USA, I'm Nadia Raymond.
My favorite Christmas music is Vince Guaraldi and the Peanuts. But after a while, it begins to drive my family and my staff a little crazy. So we decided to ask notable music writer Bill Adler, you know him from his work with Def Jam Records, to share his annual compilation of Christmas music he calls the Christmas Jollies with us. Adler's been doing this for 30 years, and he joins me now in our studio. And Bill, you have a reputation for being, let's say a little obsessed about Christmas music. And apparently, you're not the only one.
There's a kind of a subculture of mental cases like me who make a Christmas compilation year after year. The standard Christmas fare is so staid and it's so used up. I'm motivated by something different. My idea is if the standard stuff is played out and corny beyond belief, can I find an hour's worth of soulful Christmas music in a whole variety of moods, but let it be wonderful. Let it be something that bears repeated listening. And at the very least, let it kind of adhere to my taste, which is sort of not typical.
So this year in your Christmas Jollies, 5 of your 28 tracks are actually Latin music. So you have Mexican, Brazilian, Dominican, and Afro-Cuban artists on it. Which one is your favorite track this year?
My favorite track is by a singer named Freddie Martinez, who I didn't know until last year. He's got a song called Feliz Navidad, Mi Amorcito. And that's like the whole of his lyrics. I mean, he just repeats it, 30 times during the course of the song. And there's something maniacal about it, but there's also, it's so heartfelt.
Feliz Navidad, mi amorcito. Feliz Navidad, corazón. Feliz Navidad, mi amorcito. Mi amorcito. Feliz Navidad. Ahora todos.
So the truth is, my husband's from the Dominican Republic, and I know that you have 2 artists on your Christmas Jollies that are Dominican, and your favorite one is...
It's by Felix del Rosario, and it's called Felicitaciones. I played this track 15 years ago, and I had to bring it back this year. There's something so macho about the way this guy plays tenor. He's a saxophonist, and the song is mostly instrumental. And for no terribly good reason, it kind of reminds me of Coltrane. Not that he's improvising, but the sound is just so brawny.
Ooh, I want to hear a Dominican Coltrane.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, let's take a listen.
Mm-hmm.
old school. I love it. So you spend a lot of time making treks to a flea market in Chelsea in New York City. A particular stop that you make is a little stall run by a Panamanian immigrant that's got LPs.
Yeah. This guy is a character. I take a look at this man's Latin records, and it's a whole new world. I don't know, but I want to know. And, you know, I can teach myself there.
So, Bill, you're married to the TV chef, Sarah Moulton. And I hear that when she was going to be in San Antonio, that you actually made her go and buy you some Christmas records.
Yeah. I wouldn't say it's easy being married to me. It's not dull, but it's work sometimes. It's work. So she went to San Antonio and she made the mistake of telling me she had an extra half a day there. And there was a record store, I think it's called Janie's Record Store. And I got on the phone and I told them about my quest. And my dear wife went in and called me on the phone and we went through the records and I made some selections. I ended up buying, you know, $100 worth of stuff. So that was a fruitful trip. You know, this year, the Freddie Martinez comes out of that San Antonio jaunt. And last year, there was another artist, Wally Gonzalez.
Okay, I need to know the name of the song from Wally Gonzalez because I almost want to hear this one.
I think it's called Amarga Navidad.
Do you know what that means?
No. What does it mean?
It's like bitter Christmas.
Oh, okay. Well, here's what I've discovered. It turns out, I think in some parts of the Latin world, there's another version of Amarga Navidad that's a standard, and it's a sad Christmas song. And I think probably it's sad because you're not here with me at Christmas, which is fairly typical. But the way Wally Gonzalez deals with it is very funny. He kind of twists it. He says, yeah, it's bitter, but guess what? I've had enough of you.
So 2013, your Christmas jollies set is done for 2013. Are you already, really, Bill, are you already thinking about 2014?
You know what? It's kind of maniacal. I almost never stop thinking about it. And actually, one of the wonderful things is that, you know, people come to me with ideas all the time now. You know, people have heard it one year, come back the next year and say, Bill, listen, I heard something that maybe is going to make the cut for you. And so I'm open to that. And just a couple of weeks ago, I got an email out of the blue from a woman. I do not know her. She's the manager of Joe King Carrasco, who's based, you know, in Southern Texas. And she said that he's just cut a new Christmas song and she wanted me to hear it. It's called Tamale Christmas. And you know what? It's a wonderful song. I think it'll probably be there in 2014.
If our listeners want to listen to this year's Christmas Jollies, what can they do, Bill?
You're welcome to stream it.
You're giving us permission?
Of course.
LatinoUSA.org. Oh my God, we are going to have this year's Christmas Jollies made by the one and only Bill Adler. Thank you so much, Bill.
Pleasure.
All right, you heard the man. Go to our website, LatinoUSA.org. for your Christmas jollies.
It's tamale Christmas in Texas. Tamale Christmas is here. Tamale Christmas in Texas. All my friends will be there. Rolls across El Rio Grande. Nuevo Laredo. She made them by the dozen. Pecho a mano. Now they're spread all across Texas. From El Valle to San
Todos celebrando, festejando, himnos cantando, todos brindando, otro cumpleaños del niño Dios sagrado. El mejor regalo es estar rodeado de familia, salud y vida. Que esta noche Diosito nos bendiga, rica comida llena la cocina. Todos listos para entrarle, ni se diga. Llegan unos y otros más, deseándole a todo el mundo amor y paz. Y otros más, amor y paz. Feliz Navidad en el vecindario.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And this week, we're celebrating the holiday season the same way we all do, by laughing, crying, being frustrated, and all of those other emotions. Now, one big reason behind the holiday roller coaster of emotions is, let's be honest, it's La Familia. We invited a writer we love to tell us about a very special Christmas she spent with her mother and her brother. Here's Michelle Carlo with a story she calls The Return of the Queen.
Christmas Day, 2007. It's been a year of too many anniversaries. 10 years since my father died, 3 years since my 14-year marriage broke up, and 6 months since both my elderly cats had to be put to sleep. And I'm in my living room with my mother and brother after dinner, trying to watch The Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King, on a brand new DVD. Now, my mom was known as the Jackie O of East 103rd Street. She came to New York City from Puerto Rico when she was 6, and her normal speaking voice is like Jackie O. It's breathy and well-modulated, and she has absolutely no Latin accent whatsoever. But when she annoys me, like she is about to do right now, she sounds to me like the love child of Charo and Rosie Perez. Oye, mira, who is the white wizard? Gandalf, Mom? Well, you know, he's kind of like God. Well, maybe one of God's angels. Oh, and the red eye. What is that? You mean Sauron? Well, he's the devil. Well, maybe not really. Like, maybe more like his emissary? You know, like he was sent by the devil to take over the earth. Well, Middle Earth. Oh, and the one with the ring. Is he gay? In real life, Mom? I think maybe Gandalf and Pippin are, but I don't think Frodo is. Now, every time I have tried to watch any kind of TV or movie with any member of my family, it's like an episode of Mystery Science Theater 3000, only Latino style. You talk during the show and take a break only during the commercials, except that we were trying to watch a DVD, which means that there aren't any, and my brother just rewound it for the fifth time in an attempt to watch the Battle of the Pelennor Field scene once, just once, without interruption. What a hobbit? Hobbits, Mom. Little people. Oh, like dwarf? No, Mom. Gimli is the dwarf. Oh, which one is he? No, the elf? That's Legolas. It's the dwarf's friend. Oh, are they gay? Now, my mom is not and has never been dumb. And she is not and has never been homophobic. But she has, however, been obsessed with any gay movie and TV character of all time ever since one of her favorite actors of all time, Rock Hudson, had to leave her favorite TV show of all time, Dynasty. I remembered another TV watching long ago. Let's travel back to the Wayback Machine to 1985. Michelle, I hear Rock Hudson is not coming back to Dynasty. No, Mom, he's not. It's sad. He's gonna die. He has AIDS. No. He does not have AIDS. He has a cold. Mom, no, he doesn't have a cold. He has AIDS. He's gay. He is not gay. I saw him kiss Linda Evans last week, and he almost married Doris Day, too. Mom, that was in 1950. It's 1985 now. He's married to Jim Nabors. Jim Nabors? You mean Gomer Pyle? Yes, Mom. Rock Hudson married Gomer Pyle. They are gay. G-A-Y. Y-M-C-A. They're gay. 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 You know, the problem with you, Michelle, is you believe everything you read. Well, my mother doesn't believe anything she reads or sees or hears. If it contradicts what she believes to be the orderly state of the universe, then it doesn't exist. Only her universe left off in 1957 when she left accounts receivable at Gimbel's to marry my father. We rewind the DVD yet again. Michelle, those big elephants, are they supposed to be mastodons? Well, kind of, Mom, but not really. They're imaginary creatures. Oh, and the people riding on top of them with all the makeup, they're supposed to be from the Middle East, huh? Well, No, Mom, that kind of, but no, not really. They're allegorical. My mother gets this gleam of understanding in her eye, and I think, yes, oh yes, she finally gets it. But instead, she turns to the TV and she goes, Allah? So they're Osama bin Laden? Get them, Gandalf! Get them! Slay them with your white light! As I watch my mom yelling at the TV, totally animated and into it, I have to think, this is what being a family means. Everybody has their blind spot. And you just have to take people for who they are because you love them. By the time the Return of the King is over, I'm just totally exhausted. My brother is comatose, lying on the floor, but my mother is energized, sparkling, beautiful. She turns to me with her eyes bright and she tells me how great the movie was and how she wanted to read the books now. And you know, Michelle, I know. Oh, no, she's talking normal now. She doesn't have the accent anymore because she's not annoying me. You know, Michelle, I know how much you loved to read those books when you were a kid and when you were young. I want to read them now. And I get excited by this. And I tell her that I personally think that Tolkien is one of the greatest writers of all time. And I start to tell her how he and the poet C.S. Lewis were great friends and how they each put a lot of their Catholic beliefs in their writings. But she interrupts me to ask, are they gay? I can't wait to take my mom to see The Hobbit Part 2. Merry Christmas.
Michelle Carlo is a native New Yorkerican and the author of Fish Out of Agua, My Life on Neither Side of the Subway Tracks. For some people, Christmas is a time to avoid expressing an opinion, because talking politics or religion or airing the dirty laundry can certainly start a fight at dinner. But opinion is also an essential part of journalism. For this week's News or Noise, our regular segment on news literacy, producer Daisy Rosario tells us what she's learned in talking to young people about the news.
Here's a fun little bit of news trivia. People often think op-ed stands for opinion and editorial, but that's not true. It's a very common mistake, since op-eds are a place where people express opinions. But really, op-ed stands for opposite the editorial page. It's a reference to the physical layout of a newspaper. The editorial page is generally the place for opinions being put forth by the leadership of the publication itself, while op-eds are usually by someone who has nothing to do with the publication, but wants to express an opinion on a particular topic or issue. Now you know, just in case it comes up next time you're playing Jeopardy in your living room. But jokes aside, there is a bit of opinion I want to express. It's something I've learned over these last few months producing the News or Noise segments for Latino USA. Okay, bear with me. It's about millennials.
There are 80 million of them out there, and they are taking over the country.
I know.
Millennials, also known as Generation Yers.
Millennials received so many participation awards growing up.
If you've been paying attention to the echo chamber that media so often becomes, you're probably sick of the topic.
Still living with their parents.
Or should be. It certainly feels like we've talked about them enough this year.
Me, 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 me.
First, there were the articles hand-wringing about millennials. Remember Time Magazine's controversial Me, Me, Me generation cover?
The millennials.
Then came the articles defending millennials. It was a natural response. Lately, I see articles trying to discourage people from writing about millennials at all. Personally, I've never spent much time thinking about millennials, other than to try and figure out whether or not I am one. With my birth year, I'm on the cusp. I'm either the last of Generation X or the first of the millennials. If you've heard some of this past year's News or Noise segments, you know that we have spoken directly to college and high school students. The rest of the Latino USA staff could always tell when I was working on these segments. I'd walk into the office and say to everyone and no one, "Guys, I'm no longer worried about the future." It meant that I'd gotten a great quote from one of the students. But it was also a very true thing I was feeling after these interviews. I don't worry about millennials because I talk to them. And talking to them has shown me that they have a real grasp on just how complicated the world is. They understand what they will be facing as they go out into what we like to call the real world. Since I spoke largely to students interested in journalism, one could argue that they are more informed than the average young person. That might be true. But it also means I was speaking with people pursuing what so many are calling a dying industry. And yet they were always so hopeful and hungry. These young people were eager to get their voices out there and heard. They want to show the world what it isn't seeing. And maybe most impressive of all, they had the faith that they could do it. So many of the articles I've read treated millennials like a monolith. To me, that's the real problem. So just shut up about millennials. They don't need our sympathy or for us to project our fears onto them. What they do need is to be judged as individuals and to be heard. It's all anyone wants, really. For Latino USA, I'm Daisy Rosario.
And now to those who we will miss this holiday season. This month, we've been hearing the stories of people who've had to leave the U.S. against their will. We continue our series, The Dearly Deported, with the story now of Eduardo Arenas. Born in Mexico, Arenas crossed the border at 36 with a year-old son and his then-wife. Though they were undocumented, Arenas managed to get work in factories near Nashville, where he bought a house and built a life. After 12 years, he returned to Mexico to care for his sick mother. And about a year ago, Arenas crossed the border fence once again, hoping to get back to his son for the holidays. But it didn't turn out that way.
Estaba corriendo y después ya me percaté que venían unas camionetas. Un oficial de migración me esposó.
I was running and soon I saw trucks coming. An immigration official handcuffed me.
Bueno, pues nos metieron a un cuarto de 3x3.
They put us in a 10x10 room.
Y habíamos como unas 60 personas.
And there were like 60 people.
Y le suben a la calefacción a altos grados de calor.
And they jacked the heat up really high.
Se les pidió que le bajaran la calefacción, pero ellos en forma de burla decían, al rato, al rato.
They were asked to lower the heat, but they just laughed at us and said, in a sec, in a sec.
Y después te sacan a otro cuarto en la noche para donde hace mucho frío.
And later they took us out in the middle of the night to a room where it's freezing.
Se enferma uno y le pide uno una pastilla y no te la dan.
One guy got sick, requested medicine, but they didn't give it.
Pues en la mañana te daban tus galletas que son de cacahuate.
In the morning they give you peanut butter crackers.
Y en la tarde ya te daban una hamburguesita bien chiquita y un juguito.
And in the afternoon they give you a tiny slider hamburger and a little juice.
Y eso era todo lo que comías en todo el día.
And that was all you ate all day.
Bueno, no creo que me haya tratado como un ser humano.
Well, I really don't believe they treated me like a human being.
Me trataron como un animal porque lo tienen ahí encerrado más de una semana.
They treated me like an animal because they had us locked up for more than a week.
Pasé la Navidad ahí encerrado.
I spent Christmas locked up in there.
Pues la pasé muy triste pensando en la familia.
I was really sad thinking about my family. Look, I'm going to show you these photos.
Oh, sí, ahí está mi hijo. Está muy grande.
Oh, yeah, here's my son.
Tiene 14 años. Él vive con su mamá.
He's big now, 14 years old. He lives with his mom.
Bueno, yo estoy viviendo en el Distrito Federal.
I'm living in Mexico City.
Quisiera regresar, pero bueno, mi plan es poner un negocio de plásticos.
I would like to go back to the States, but right now my plan is to start a business selling plastics.
Entonces yo no estoy arrepentido de haber llegado aquí.
So, I don't regret having come back here.
Y sabiendo que mi hijo está allá en Estados Unidos, que está bien, porque como quiera él está saliendo adelante, eso no me preocupa.
And knowing that my son is okay in the U.S., because just as he wants, he's getting ahead, that doesn't worry me.
Lo que sí me preocupaba es...
What did worry me was not getting home in time to say goodbye to my mother for the last time.
No llegarle a dar el último adiós a mi madre.
Eduardo Arenas' story came to us from producer Jennifer Collins. And if you know someone who's been deported and wants to tell us their story, let us know via Twitter. We're at LatinoUSA. Feliz Navidad, queridos. Be safe and stay warm. That's our program for this week. And for our credits today, we're going to try something different. Our production staff includes...
Carolina González Madera. My siblings actually got to pick out my name. I was named after...
Caroline Kennedy.
Ariel Carlos Winter Valdez. I was named after the wind spirit character in The Tempest. To my shame, I've never actually read The Tempest.
Michael Hardy Jones. My devout Irish Catholic mother, God rest her soul, named me after bad St. Michael the Archangel, who defeated Satan and cast him out of heaven.
Lita Marissa Hartman Garcia de Barnes. My father was an English professor, and he named me after the Greek woman who gave birth to Castor and Pollux and Helen of Troy.
Yo, my name is Daisy Marie Rosario, but when I was born, my name was Daisy Marie Collazo. That's my mother's last name. Okay, so my initials are DMR, but that means my initials used to be DMC. And I was a child in Brooklyn in the 80s. So I thought having the initials DMC was pretty much the coolest thing ever because of Run DMC.
Brenda Patricia Salinas Páez. My sister picked the name Brenda because she watched a lot of Beverly Hills 90210, and I guess she thought the name was cool.
Michael Simon Johnson. Michael came from a name book. My parents just wanted to name me something biblical.
Marlon Hunter Bishop. My dad was a big film buff. He decided to name me after Marlon Brando. My middle name was named after Hunter S. Thompson. It's a pretty nice name.
Nancy Erika Trujillo.
My dad was undocumented, and through Reagan's amnesty, my dad received citizenship. And my mom was extremely grateful. She decided to name me Nancy after Nancy Reagan, after Ronald Reagan's wife.
Nadia Raymond Chacon. I am Latino USA's music consultant. My dad was really, really into Russia, and he really liked the name Nadiezhda, which means hope. And Nadia is a shorter version, and it was the only name that my mom liked and agreed to.
Our interns are
Eva Marjorie DeLapp. My paternal great-grandmother, her name was Eva, and she escaped from Hungary during World War II.
Jonathan Andrew Fernandez Gonzalez Wolf.
After DOMA was struck down, I got married. We went to the courthouse in Brooklyn, and we wanted to create our own name, but the person there said it was too difficult, and so then it became Fernandez Gonzalez Wolf. Yeah, kind of complicated things, and we have really long names on our credit cards now, but yeah, everything worked out.
Additional engineering this week by
Stephanie Diane LeBeau. My parents named me after Stevie Nicks, and then hoped that Stevie would catch on as a nickname, but it didn't.
Special thanks to John Kalish. Our program was founded at the University of Texas at Austin, and I'm your host and executive producer. And get ready for it, because I've always wanted to sign off this way. I'm Maria de Lourdes Hinojosa Ojeda. Ta-da! Join us again next week, and in the meantime, find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. Felicidades, everyone!
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all. And the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. News or Noise is funded by the Why News Matters initiative at the McCormick Foundation, fostering communities of educated, informed, and engaged citizens.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives on the web at hewlett.org. The Lemelson Foundation, supporting inventors and invention to improve lives in the U.S. and developing countries on the web at lemelson.org. The Annie E. Casey Foundation, developing solutions to support strong families and communities for America's children at aecf.org. This is NPR.